At least, he never had to work for the son of a bitch again. No more long hours in the pit, putting paladins back together and Vector coming by supposedly to say, "Nice job, you can expect a bonus," but in truth to stare at Chiden's shapely behind like it was a steak and he hadn't eaten for 3 days. Only when Chiden wasn't looking, of course. It was a courtesy Vector hadn't extended to Ido. Well, Chiden was on the menu now. Ido wondered if Vector had moved her in yet, or whether he would go through the motions of courting her for a few days. No, he wouldn't waste any more time locking down her services for his mortarball players. He probably hadn't done sooner just to allow what he thought was a decent period of time since the tragedy. That was how Vector referred to their daughter's death. The tragedy. Ido thought if he had ever heard Vector speak his daughter's name, he'd plant the rocket hammer in his face. How smooth would he be after that? God, he needed something else to think about, something that wasn't Vector or Chiden. Shut up, Ido told himself. Work. He had 4 replacement arms laid out on his largest workbench. Most of the components in each one were of the same generation, or close enough that hesitation and dropout wouldn't be a problem for the cyborg. He'd found a way to make newer parts more backwards compatible with older parts, but some parts were just too old. He'd had some luck with rebuilding the older parts to fool them into thinking they were newer by resetting some of the interrupts. That was a new skill he'd taught himself quite recently. Dr. Dyson Ido, cyber surgeon, heavy on the cyber. The chip he was working on would make all the old fiddles and tricks unnecessary, he hoped. At the moment, the chip was installed in a double arm he'd been upgrading for a musician. Hector played double-necked guitar, and he made brilliant music with the vintage instrument. But then the signals for his fingering began scrambling on him. I know it ain't life and death, Doc, and maybe nobody really needs to hear me playing classical pieces in the marketplace all day, but it's a living. It's my living, anyway. And if I can't play, I might as well lie down and die. Without music, we all might as well lie down and die, Ido told him, meaning it. And it was a relief to work on something that had nothing to do with the factory or bounty hunting. The guitar player's double arm was highly complex. Whoever had designed it had been a cut above the usual techie hardhead. This was the product of someone who knew something about music and musical instruments. When Ido had asked the musician about it, however, the man had been vague and obviously uncomfortable. Ido hadn't pressed the matter. People in Iron City knew that talking too much never ended well. Ido could relate. He didn't like answering questions about himself either. Besides, all he needed to know was right there in the arm. The chip worked well in the arm, but only on the short term. Hector said he improvised a lot when he played. Tests showed the chip would speed up the signals from his nerves a little too much, so that it would be more like the chip was playing the guitar than the man. A fast chip didn't belong on a slow job. Ido had fixed the hardware to operate virtually free of conflicts, but Hector still had to come in and play while Ido fine-tuned him so he could get the kind of movement he wanted. The chip itself needed a lot more work. Speeding up nerve signals so movement felt as natural as it did for someone fully organic was a good idea in theory, but the chip kept jumping the gun. It would anticipate the next signals in the sequence a little earlier each time. That was okay for a robot program to do one thing repeatedly. For a cyborg, a human being, the chip could get so far ahead of the nerve signals that it took over and the person lost autonomy and control. Chiden probably would have accused him of letting his perfectionist tendencies sabotage tech that was acceptable, if not quite up to his lofty benchmark. The pursuit of perfection is the enemy of good, she'd told him more than once. He might have been more inclined to her point of view if she'd been talking about art, where there might be a million right answers or none at all. But Ido had always operated on the basis that there was an ocean of difference between good and good enough. Settling for the latter, when you could attain the former with more time and effort, was, well, not good enough. Now Chiden could have everything her way. Good, good enough, functional for now. It was her call, and no one would argue with her. Vector would just tell her to hurry up. Other than that, Vector would spoil her rotten with a laboratory full of nothing but the best, all stuff he'd skimmed from shipments bound for Zalem. He'd be as ostentatious about it as possible, to make sure Ido would know what he was missing now that he wasn't working in the pits anymore. And he did miss it. At first, he hadn't been sure he wanted to work on giant armored cyborgs that dismembered each other while chasing a quirky motorized ball around a snaking track. He'd never watched any of the broadcasts on Zalem, but the game had hooked him faster than he cared to admit, even to himself. Some kind of testosterone thing, he supposed. There were no activities in Zalem that involved extreme violence at high speed, nothing that would induce a man to feel like standing up and pounding his chest while he bellowed a challenge to the immediate world. Of course, this didn't take the female players into account. Or Motorball's popularity among people of any sex who weren't given to displays of brute force. For Chiden, it was pure escapism. She stopped thinking about where she didn't live and what she didn't have. If Vector had somehow been able to get his limo into the pit, Chiden would have turned it into a paladin, no questions asked. She really was that good, better than Ido was. She liked having to think fast in the pressure cooker. She liked being the paladin's only hope, hero to the motorball heroes, not the mother who got kicked out of heaven for producing a defective child. Ido wondered how much she had amped that up since she'd left him. How manic did she get? What did she have to do to get herself up there? And how did she come down afterwards? If she hadn't been crazy before, she probably was now. Damn it, he'd sat down at the workbench to put her and Vector out of his mind. Ido took the chip out of the guitar player's double arm and replaced it with a more conventional type of controller, one that wouldn't get ahead of the musician. He ran a brief diagnostic with a sheet music subroutine just to see the movement. Watching the fingers play invisible frets was a bit trippy, but everything looked good. The next arm on the table had a hand that could be swapped for an array of surgical instruments. This one was for a nurse who'd been sideswiped by a truck. It had taken her left arm off at the shoulder. He was briefly acquainted with Gerhard. She'd sent a few patients from the ER his way, but that wasn't the only reason he liked her. She was a very good nurse. You had to be to work in an emergency room, and she thought her career was over. What she made at the hospital wouldn't have bought her so much as an elbow joint. Would she ever be surprised when he showed her what he'd cooked up for her? Ido really hoped she liked it, because he wanted to offer her a job, too. What he made as a bounty hunter would be enough to tempt her with a better income than she had at the hospital. Getting a good nurse in to work with him would make his life so much easier. He could train Gerhard as a full nurse practitioner, so she could prescribe lower-level drugs and prep patients for surgery. Together, they could help more people than he could alone. Yeah, the Dyson Ido Clinic. One-stop shop for all your cyber needs. Lifeline for indigent cyborgs. Lives would not only be saved, they'd be improved. And all he'd have to do was collect one or two extra bounties per night. One or two extra heads. Dr. Dyson Ido, life-saving cybersurgeon by day, deadly hunter warrior by night. Licensed by the factory to kill. Where would you end up? Under the knife or under the hammer? Cure or kill? No refunds. All sales are final. Ido put his head in his hands. He could not let himself spiral. The last time had been that night, when he'd spiraled right out of his mind. He had been spiraling when he'd marched into the factory to get a bounty hunter's license. He'd looked calm enough to pass for normal, but then normal in Iron City was an extremely broad and highly vague designation. In any case, the deckman hadn't challenged him, and the Centurions hadn't pointed their weapons at him. Apparently, they hadn't picked up on the fact that he was a hair's breadth from losing his shit and screaming his grief and rage until his voice gave out. Or they'd determined that would pose no threat to the factory. It probably wouldn't have mattered if he'd come in stark naked, covered in mud and calling himself the Queen of May. As long as he'd directed any homicidal tendencies towards criminals with prices on their heads, he wasn't their worry. Or maybe he was wrong, and the Centurions would have shot him if he'd put a foot out of line. You never really knew with Centurions. You weren't supposed to. In any case, they'd given him his license and told him to read the fine print on the back, which was the Hunter's Code. That was all he needed to become one of Iron City's Hunter Warriors. Some of them were good men, like Master Clive Lee and McTeague with his hellhounds. Others were cruel and violent, like Zapan, who seemed to spend all his money on plastic surgery. The rest were mostly ex-motorball players, which answered a question he had never thought to ask, namely, what happened to those who washed out or got cut from the team? Back when he and Chiden had been busy building bigger and better paladins, he'd never wondered about the players who never made the big time. Now he knew. If they didn't end up on the street selling off parts for a fix of the performance drugs, they might get work as hired muscle in the ever-popular security industry. If they were really lucky, Vector would put them on his payroll. Or they pulled themselves together and became hunter warriors. Ito was one of the very few residents of Iron City who knew any real history, not just about the war, but also how things had been before that, when civilization had been more orderly and regulated, and civil servants protected the weak and, if possible, prevented the strong from victimizing them. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. There had been problems. The haves had so much more than the have-nots, and corruption had kept it that way. Other problems were inherent to the system. Bureaucracy slowed the process of justice. People were convicted of crimes they hadn't committed and spent years trapped in overcrowded prisons, and if they hadn't been criminals when they'd gone in, they were when they came out. If they came out. Now there were only hunter warriors and centurions. Crimes against persons all had the same penalty, carried out either by a hunter warrior or a centurion. Case closed. With very few exceptions, hunter warriors were only allowed to take the heads of those with markers on them. Once the identity was verified by the factory, the hunter could collect the bounty and spend it at a hunter warrior hangout like the Kansas Bar. Poaching another hunter's mark was expressly forbidden by the Hunter Code and was grounds for execution. That was as complicated as it ever got. Under this streamlined system, however, there was no provision specifically for the protection of the weak. In Iron City, the best thing you could do was not be weak and hang around other people who were also not weak. As for the question of what hunter warriors could do if they sustained any damage or serious injury in the course of taking down a mark, that was an easy one. You went to Doc Ito's clinic, and he'd fix you right up, even if you'd lost the bounty and couldn't pay. This was quite a recent development, but it was in keeping with the original idea behind the clinic. Ito had met a lot of hunter warriors that way, even before he became one of them. Putting them back together, rewiring nervous systems, replacing rib cages and pelvic connectors. They were grateful and paid as and when they could, even tipping him off to an especially profitable mark to support the clinic. He was the total package, healer of cyborgs and killer of criminals. Dyson Edo, cyber surgeon and professional contradiction. First, do no harm. That wasn't actually part of the Hippocratic Oath. Neither was kill or cure. Well, it could have been worse, Edo thought, reaching for the third arm on his workbench. That was another feature of life in Iron City. No matter how bad anything was, it could always be worse. No matter how far down you fell, you'd find there was at least one more level lower than that. Well, unless you ended up with your head in a bag. Then you were done. You couldn't fall off that floor. His daughter's face appeared in his mind's eye, pale, her lips a little blue from the exertion of pushing herself around in her chair.
I'll use the motor later, Daddy. I want to build up my arm muscles. Check it. My biceps are already bigger.
Oh, yes. It could have been so much worse. His daughter hadn't lived to see what a sorry pass he had come to. If she had, Edo wouldn't have been able to look her in the eye. He put his head down on the workbench and let himself fall apart. It had been some weeks since the last time. He might as well get it over with so he could pull himself together and get back to work on these damned arms. 3 hours later, he woke to find he'd been tightly gripping one of the cyborg hands with his own, as if he'd needed to hold on for dear life. He raised his head and slowly let go of the cyborg hand. He uncurled his fingers slowly, absently aware his ribs hurt a lot more now.
Thanks for the helping hand, he told the cyborg arm silently. Otherwise, who knows how far I would have fallen.
Chapter 9
He lives! Tanji said, as Hugo joined him and Koyomi outside the Café Café. Your face looks better. More like a human's.
Thanks, said Hugo. Can't say the same about yours.
Koyomi laughed.
Ooh, he gotcha!
She ran a hand through Tanji's frizzy halo of hair.
And the dew isn't even warm after a burn like that. It's a miracle!
Tanji pushed her hand away, but without much effort. How much longer were the two of them going to dance around each other, Hugo wondered. They were starting to drive him crazy. Koyomi turned Hugo on the sidewalk as he was facing the late afternoon sun.
Yeah, definitely a lot better, she said, peering at his face. I'd never know just by looking at you that you got beat up for your lunch money.
She frowned slightly.
Are you ever going to tell us what really happened? Jealous boyfriend? Pissed off cyborg?
Hugo grimaced. Something stupider, he said, then hesitated. Tanji and Koyomi were his closest friends. If he didn't tell him about it, he'd never tell anyone. He hadn't even told Edo the whole story. The doc had just patched him up, no questions asked, for which he'd been grateful. Some things he didn't want to talk about, but he didn't need one more thing to carry around all by himself.
Okay, he said after a bit. But this stays between the three of us. The rest of the crew doesn't have to know.
Koyomi mimed locking her lips with a key while Tanji raised his left hand and put his right over his heart.
I was down in Southie, Hugo began. On purpose? Koyomi made an incredulous face. Did your brain fall out of the holes in your head?
If you wanted to get beat up, you could have just asked me, Tanji said. I'd have punched you out and saved you the trip. Unless you wanted to pick up lice, too. That's all they got in Southie. Beatdowns, lice, and some incurable skin diseases.
Hugo sighed heavily.
Let me know when you guys are done.
Give me a second.
Tanji frowned as if he were thinking hard.
Yeah, I'm done. You?
He tugged one of Koyomi's skinny braids.
I'm good for now. She turned back to Hugo. You were saying?
His friends listened as Hugo told them about the bracelet, although he left out the part about going to live with his brother and Nana and the drone that never was, saying only that he'd run away from home after his mother died. Tanji had already known Hugo's father had been a TR, but the whole thing was new to Koyomi. She looked so upset, Hugo was afraid she might cry. Neither of them gave him any grief about his swiping the bracelet off the woman's arm, which surprised him. He'd expected Tanji, at least, to say something about the kind of people who took other people's stuff, but his friend didn't look even slightly disturbed by what he'd done. "I know, I should have stayed out of Southie," Hugo added after he finished the story. "I didn't even really know where I was, just that I was by the trash pile, and that belongs to everybody."
"The Southtown crew's been trying to shake a claim on that part of the trash pile," Tanji told him. "They've been hassling people picking there. They got into it a couple of times with the Westies after they chased off one of their aunts or cousins or something."
Hugo winced.
"Well, geez, don't you think you could have maybe mentioned this? Because if I'd known, I'd have been more careful." "You didn't ask," Tanji said coolly. "But you being our fearless leader and all, I'd have thought you already knew, because you know everything, right? Including everything they do in Southie."
Hugo gave him a look.
"No, that's your job. I'm your fearless leader. You're supposed to tell me things." "My mistake," Tanji said.
He was deadpan, but Hugo could see he was getting tense. Tanji ran hot sometimes. You had to know when he'd had enough.
"Hey, I'm just busting your chops," Hugo said. "Getting caught in Southtown's on me alone. I feel stupid."
Tanji relaxed visibly.
"That was lousy, you getting worked over and losing your mom's bracelet to some punk-ass Southie garbage eater. I know you got nothing from your folks."
He put his hands in his pockets, looking self-conscious and awkward. No one spoke for a long moment. Then Hugo said,
"Well?"
"What?"
Tanji's eyes narrowed. Hugo spread his hands.
"I'm waiting for the insult. Unless you've gone soft on me."
"Hey, dead mom,"
Tanji said, his expression slightly appalled as well as surprised.
"You don't rag on a dead mom, everybody knows that. Oh wait, I forgot. They adopted you from one of McTeague's hellhound litters. You're doing good just walking on your hind legs."
"That's better," Hugo said. "For a second there, I was afraid you were going to start talking about your feelings."
"Aw, do you need a good cry?" Tanji asked.
"Jeez, get a room, you two."
Koyomi stepped between them and pushed them farther apart.
"Or one of you buy me an iced coffee for making me listen to that crap."
She went into the cafe, and they followed. The three of them waited out the rest of the day at the far end of the counter that ran along the front window. A month earlier, Hugo had done a deal with the cafe owner on some hard-to-get parts for some kind of fancy coffee machine. The owner was attached to it for some reason and didn't want to get rid of it. Hugo found the right replacement parts and offered him a discount if he'd let Hugo and his crew hang out. The owner agreed, as long as they didn't screw up his business. Tanji had told him he should have gone for the money, but having a place to get in out of the rain 24 hours a day turned him around. Besides, Vector paid them enough to make up for it. In fact, Hugo had just had another meeting in the back seat of Vector's limo, which had gone better than the last one. Vector still wasn't quite over Hugo's delivering late.
"A man with as many responsibilities as I have counts on a certain level of excellence," Vector had said, "and it's no small thing to be let down."
Hugo knew he'd be hearing some variation on that from Vector for a long time. Today, however, Vector had something he was a lot more pissed off about. It seemed there was a total replacement cyborg walking around not designed or built by anyone Vector controlled. There was a new designer engineer in town, which was why Vector couldn't get his hands on the specs. But from what he'd heard, the TR was superior to anything Vector had. No one seemed to know where this new designer engineer had come from, except that her forehead was unmarked, so she hadn't fallen from Zalem. Somewhere out in the Badlands was about as specific as it got. The Badlands lay beyond the area surrounding Iron City, where the factory ran its arming operations. Out there, the contamination from the war had decreased enough that fields and forests and even some wildlife had come back, but it was deemed by Zalem's authority to still be too high for human habitation. There were people living in the Badlands, although no one was sure who or how many or even where, as no one was sure how far the Badlands extended before becoming the wasteland that the factory said made up most of the planet. If anything lived out there, it was probably mutated creatures that roamed the poison landscape looking for things to eat alive. The factory wasn't actually responsible for that last bit of speculation, but it didn't discourage it. Fear of the unknown made people less whimsical and thus more easily controlled. All anyone really knew was people who left Iron City never came back, and no one thought that was because they'd found something better. There was something better, but it wasn't out in the Badlands. It was floating in mid-air, and Iron City lived in its shadow. Sometimes people did come to Iron City from elsewhere. Not often, but once in a while. They arrived without fanfare, unnoticed except by the factory, which regulated every part of life in Iron City, and Vector, who kept track of anyone with an unknown pedigree because there was no such thing as a nice surprise. Miss Cyborg Designer had arrived 10 or 11 months earlier, a slightly dumpy woman nearing the upper boundary of middle age. Vector had thought she looked like a schoolteacher, but he never made assumptions. In fact, she did teach for a while in a private elementary school in Northland, although she actually lived in a two-room dump on the edge of the slum district. After 6 months, she quit and seldom left her sorry little apartment. Vector put her under surveillance, using a special team that none of his other employees knew about. They reported she seemed to be tutoring a select group of Northland children who went to her place in the slum district. Anyone else on Vector's payroll might have left it at that, but this particular team operated on the premise that all behavior was deceptive. Eventually, after a lot of patient observation and some undetected breaking and entering, the team reported to Vector that the schoolteacher was a cyborg designer and engineer. She had built a total replacement cyborg with a number of improvements to the central nervous system. Said cyborg had registered for the next motorball tryout session. Vector was no engineer, but he'd picked up a few things. Looking at Miss Designer's schematic, his first impression was that the cyborg was too overbuilt to function. It was packing 3 times as many nerves in each part of the body. Everything fed into the spine, which had been completely reconfigured in a way Vector had never seen. He told Hugo his new tuner had been impressed. Chidan said it must have taken years of trial and error to get it right, which he figured explained why she hadn't made one of these for him already. Thank God someone already had. It would save them years of work. The problem was, Miss Designer didn't want to sell Vector her design, and she didn't want to go to work for him. She had a group of 6 financiers looking after her expenses, and they didn't interfere with her work or try to boss her around. They didn't even make her move to Northland. This little cabal apparently thought their TR was going to wipe the floor with everyone else at tryouts. Maybe he would, or maybe he'd blow up on his way to the starting line. But the only way to be sure was to take him before he got to the stadium. Vector wanted that spine and all its connectors, along with anything else they could dig out of him. But the spine was the priority, backbone included. Once he got the cyborg, Vector said, he wasn't too worried about the Northland bunch. Apparently, they'd thought they could use the cyborg to take control of Motorball before knocking Vector out of his position with the factory. As if they had a chance. The factory didn't want 6 people doing a job currently handled by one. One man, one word, was all it took to get the job done. Any job. All of this was far more than Hugo had ever wanted to know. Normally, Vector told him what he needed done, and one way or another, he did it. But since Hugo had been late, just that one time, he supposed Vector felt the need to explain why the job was important. Maybe if he got this one right, Hugo thought, he might regain all the ground he'd lost and everything would be okay again. At least, Vector hadn't called off the other deal they'd made, and Hugo knew Vector could never have got where he was now by making promises he didn't intend to keep. If the factory could take Vector at his word, Hugo could too, and he'd never let him down ever again. Hugo didn't share all the details with Tanji and Koyomi. Tanji would have been bored, and Koyomi would have asked what all that had to do with how they were going to do the job. He did explain that the cyborg might be more difficult to take down, but Tanji only shrugged.
"I'm at full charge,"
he said, patting the sleeve where he kept his paralyzer bolt.
"I'm good for the next 2 days, and I don't think it'll take that long, unless he's shockproof."
"Not that I know of," Hugo said. "I don't think even the doc could do that." "You sure like him, don't you?" Koyomi said. "Doc Ido, I mean. You're always hanging out there." "Not lately," Hugo said. "I haven't seen him since he patched me up, and I only went to him because I didn't want to sit in the emergency room for 7 hours with my split lip the size of a salami."
"The size of a salami," Tanji said. "I'll believe it when I see it."
"Are you asking to see it?" Hugo asked, deadpan. Koyomi rolled her eyes. "When's the wedding? I want to save up for your gift."
"Tanji wants a salami," Hugo said. "Hugo doesn't have one," said Tanji.
"You guys are killing me," Koyomi said. "Just kiss already, will ya?" The three of them slipped out of the cafe shortly after 11. The traffic in Iron City was starting to segue into late-night calm. Iron City was at its quietest in the dead of night, though it was never completely still. The factory never slept. There was always a shipment to be packed or inspected, or things to be cut, sewn, glued, stamped, etched, painted, hammered, polished, assembled, inspected, and sent up through one of the supply tubes that extended from one of the distribution centers to Zalim like long spider legs. If you were close enough to one of the tubes, you could even hear a shipment whooshing upward. But you could see and hear the sound of Zalim dumping their trash from almost anywhere in Iron City. Even at the busiest times of the day, when Iron City was wall-to-wall engines, blaring horns, kids yelling, and all kinds of business getting done, you could always hear Zalim flush the toilet. Well, that wasn't really what it was, of course. Hugo had heard Ido mutter the phrase, and the expression had stuck in his head. If it wasn't real excrement that came out of Zalim's waste chute, it might as well have been for the way it felt at ground level. And maybe from up there the feeling was mutual. This only made Hugo more resolved. Just because you'd been born in a trash can didn't mean you had to stay there. People might think those were the rules, so you had to make your own rules.
"What are we doing here?" asked Koyomi as she got off the back of Tanji's gyro.
They were in the loading area of an abandoned warehouse behind the ruins of the old cathedral.
"I thought you said the cyborg would be at some place back in the slum district or near there, and it's 3 or 4 blocks back that way."
"He is," Hugo said, "but he won't be out on the street where we can get him for another 2 hours."
"How can you be so sure?" Koyomi asked him.
"Yeah," said Tanji. "What if he's early or late? You got his schedule for the rest of the week?"
Hugo made a face at him. "I've been told where he'll be and when. He won't be out on the street before 1 a.m. It's 2 blocks to the stop for the all-night bus to Northland. We can pick him up on the way."
"Then what?"
Tanji asked.
"Do we just take him apart on the spot and wave at anybody watching us? Or do you know any deserted streets on the bus route?"
"That's the good news," Hugo said. "We've got something even better." He took them down to the end of the loading dock to something with a tarp over it. Hugo pulled it off.
Oh, great,
Tanji said sourly, folding his arms.
You got half a truck. Did it come with half a sandwich? How long till you get the other half?
Oh, lighten up, Koyomi said, walking around the narrow green and white truck. Skinnies look weird, but they're good for getting through traffic, as long as it runs. She looked at Hugo.
It runs fine, Hugo said. How do you think I got it here?
Only you could buy half a truck.
Tanji jumped up on the step to look through the driver's side window.
It's got a back seat. I guess it has to. You can't fit three across.
The best part's back here. Hugo led them around to the back of the truck and opened the rear door. There was a winch with a lot of thick cable as well as heavy-looking restraints screwed into the floor. We hook the guy up to the cable and pull him in, then strap him down and take him someplace else to part him out, Hugo pointed. There's enough room for both our gyros, too.
You got a place we can keep it between jobs? Tanji said. Like, in a whole truck, maybe?
We don't have to use it for every job, Hugo said. Just tough ones. Like when there's only three of us, and we might want to use it for other things, not just jobs.
Tanji gave a short, incredulous laugh.
Like what?
I don't know, Hugo said. Maybe take it out to the Badlands. We could find something out there we couldn't carry on a gyro.
Like what?
Tanji laughed again.
No, I know what you're thinking. That thing in the lake wouldn't fit in a whole truck, let alone this one.
There's still lots of other stuff inside it, Hugo said.
Underwater!
Tanji looked appalled.
You can dive for treasure if you want. Count me out.
Something could have floated to the surface or washed up on the shore, Hugo said. We haven't been out there in a while.
Where'd you get this thing anyway? Koyomi asked.
Vector, replied Hugo.
Vector gave you a truck?
Tanji looked even more incredulous.
Don't you mean half a truck? Hugo said. And he didn't exactly give it to me. He said I can use it whenever I need it.
He probably got tired of trying to find a place to park it, Tanji said.
What do you care as long as he pays?
Hugo asked him evenly. Tanji shrugged.
Good point. So Vector gives a truck. Can I drive?
The cyborg finally came out of an apartment building in the middle of the block just before 3 a.m. The guy was larger than Vector had led them to believe. Anyone trying out for motorball was going to be on the big side, but this cyborg was 7 feet tall in his street body, with big, overbuilt shoulders and long arms shaped as if they were muscles. He reminded Hugo of Gruishka in his early days, before everything had gone bad for him and he'd been banned from the game for life. That had to be why Vector wanted him so badly. A lot of people had lost big money on Gruishka's last game, Vector included. Not enough to clean him out, but Vector hated losing. Hugo wondered what had happened to Gruishka, if he'd really gone back into the sewer like everyone said. They were parked in an alley off the street a little over a block away from the bus stop, with Koyomi in the driver's seat. She turned to say something to Hugo and he shushed her, telling her to cover up. Obediently, she pulled down her goggles, tied a bandana around the lower half of her face, then pulled up the hood on her jacket. Hugo and Tanji did the same.
"Should I pull out?" she whispered. "He's getting close."
Hugo shushed her again.
"I'll bang on the door, and don't stall it too soon."
He and Tanji slipped out of the passenger side door and watched the guy approach. When he was about 10 feet away, Hugo banged the door twice, and Koyomi pulled the truck into the street in front of the cyborg with a jerk.
"What the hell?"
Hugo heard the cyborg yell.
"Sorry,"
Koyomi said in a shrill little girl voice.
"Watch it,"
the guy snapped. His footsteps went towards the rear of the truck. Tanji moved quickly around the opposite end to sneak up behind him. Hugo stepped out in front of the cyborg as he cleared the back of the truck. The cyborg stopped short with an expression of bewildered surprise. Hugo felt the same. The cyborg looked so much younger in person. He couldn't have been more than 16, Hugo thought. Or maybe that was just the curly ginger hair and the freckles, because he was big, husky as well as tall. Maybe they should have had two more of the crew with them.
"What the hell are you supposed to be?"
the cyborg said. Hugo tapped the cyborg's knee with his paralyzer bolt. He went down with a yell, and Tanji hit him in the back of the neck with his own paralyzer. The cyborg flopped on the pavement, arms and legs thrashing. He tried to call out, but only made grunting noises. Tanji hesitated, then hit him again in the same place. Now the cyborg shuddered violently, as if the whole street were vibrating, and went limp. Alarmed, Tanji touched a finger to his neck.
"He's alive," he whispered to Hugo.
Hugo knelt down to take a close look at his face, lifting one of his eyelids.
"Let's get him in the truck."
"Some super cyborg," Tanji said as he opened the back door. "Vector better not ask for a refund if his big deal turns out to be a hunk of junk."
Hugo worried that the cyborg might start coming around after they got him strapped down in the truck, but he remained limp and unconscious. Some cyborgs never lost consciousness, but those were the really tough guys. The adrenaline rush kept them wide awake, even if they were drunk or high. Hugo hated jacking one of those because they never shut up the whole time they were being separated from their body. They kept cursing and telling you all the ways they were going to kill you, and you could barely hear yourself think. Sometimes they were still cursing when you dropped their core on the street. Hugo imagined they were still running their mouths when the prefects picked them up and put them on life support. Hugo always tipped off the prefects after he dumped a core, anonymously, of course, but sometimes he thought the prefects could find them just by the sound of their non-stop bitching. Tonight, however, he'd have almost preferred to have the guy cursing and swearing at him. He really looked dead. Young and dead. Whoever had built him had really messed up. Maybe it was all that extra stuff Vector said he had in his spine. The engineer had enhanced him, but it looked to Hugo like she'd forgotten to make a fighter out of him. And the way he'd reacted to Hugo, "What the hell are you supposed to be?" Like, it never occurred to him he would get jacked. Like, he didn't even know what a jacker was. As he and Tanji worked on severing the first set of connections between his core and the cyborg body, Hugo couldn't help feeling sorry for him. Hugo insisted they'd leave the core near the market district, where the prefects would find him quickly. Tanji didn't argue. Hugo could tell he also felt funny about the way things had gone down, although Tanji would never have admitted it to anyone, especially Hugo. But Tanji made a point of keeping Koyomi out of the chop process this time, telling her to stand watch instead. Anything that could spook Tanji had to be bad. The delivery address Vector gave them was an old annex to the factory building. When they pulled the truck up next to it, Hugo was afraid for a moment that Vector had set them up to be eliminated as loose ends. But as it turned out, Vector had made the annex into a fancy laboratory for his new favorite tuner, Doc Ito's ex-wife. Hugo had never seen anything so elaborate and lavish. It was at least four times the size of Doc Ito's clinic, with a lot more equipment. Some of the machines were upgrades of things he'd seen the doc use, but others he couldn't identify at all. Chiden's instruments were in display cases, like they were supposed to be admired when she wasn't using them. She even had a small staff, although they looked a lot more like bodyguards than nurses. The doctor herself looked more like she was going to one of Vector's fancy parties. Hugo had never seen a tuner in stilettos. Normally, Hugo would simply have dropped the requested parts off, collected his payment, and gone home. But this time, he felt compelled to tell Vector how clueless the cyborg had seemed and how easily he'd gone down. Vector's tuner, Chiden, had shown a great deal of interest, asking him to tell her exactly what happened, making him go back over certain details about how the cyborg had behaved. Her face was intensely serious, her ice-blue eyes looking hard into his as if she could stare information out of him. Hugo had only seen her at a distance when she'd still been with the doc, before their daughter died, but even then she'd looked like she never found much to smile about. She interrogated him for something like half an hour. Then Vector paid them and added a small bonus for useful information. The sky was getting light when Hugo finally made it back to his single-room apartment. Maybe it had been the job, or having to answer so many questions about the TR cyborg for Chiden, or simply the fact that he'd been awake for over 24 hours, but he was suddenly overwhelmed by a mix of pity and anger. Pity for people who got victimized, and anger at those who benefited by it. Normally, Hugo didn't think about this sort of thing if he could possibly avoid it. There was no point in agonizing over anything. He couldn't do anything about it. He was doing well just keeping himself together. But now he was too tired to resist. Then he remembered the bag of credits in his jacket pocket. He dug a dented metal box out from behind the loose board on the floor of his one and only closet. It was a little over half full now. Not enough yet for what he needed, but he was getting there. He added most of the night's take to it, keeping only the bare minimum he needed for the next day, and felt a little better as he put the box back in its hiding place. As soon as he lay down, he fell into a deep and mercifully dreamless sleep. Chapter 10. The woman in the plush chair on the other side of Vector's enormous desk was beautiful when she wanted to be. Vector was very pleased Soledad had made the choice to be beautiful this afternoon. He preferred his women beautiful, especially when he met with them in his luxurious office. Not everyone got to meet beautiful Soledad. In her line of work, being forgettable paid better. They didn't make them like Soledad anymore. Having a mutable facial structure was now a criminal offense, but the factory allowed her to retain the ability to alter her appearance as long as she was useful and didn't engage in unauthorized deception. The fact that she'd managed to swing such a deal made her beautiful and smart, something Vector greatly respected. You could get away with a lot if you were beautiful, but if you were beautiful and smart, you could get away with anything. Soledad was one of Vector's most closely held secrets. Virtually everyone else on his staff thought she was a janitor, that is, someone's mentally impaired relative Vector employed as a favor, doing manual labor for minimal pay. It wasn't so unlikely, as Vector actually did employ a few mentally or physically disabled people as a favor to their loved ones. It made him look good, like he actually had a heart. Better yet, however, it kept said loved ones continuously in his debt, making it impossible for them to refuse whatever he asked of them. Soledad moved among all of them unnoticed, observing and listening and reporting anything of interest. She was also highly accomplished at breaking and entering. If there were any places Soledad couldn't gain entry to, they weren't in Iron City. Once inside, she could search the whole place thoroughly and leave no trace. She stole only on request and took only what she had been asked to take, which made her beautiful, smart, and strong-willed. A combination that was so rare in Iron City as to be non-existent. It was rarer even than ex-residents of Zalem, neither of whom Vector thought of as strong-willed. He was very glad Soledad worked for him, although he didn't kid himself. She worked for him because the factory wanted her to. But as long as she took orders from him, it didn't really matter. Vector got up and went around to lean on the front of his desk, leaving his glass of scotch where it was. He wasn't sure looming over this woman would have any effect on her, but it was always good to remind employees he was above them.
"You understand it's crucial that we get this chip, and that Ido not know we've taken it for as long as possible," Vector said. "I'm sorry we don't have an exact image of what you'll be looking for.
The sketch Dr. Chiren made is detailed enough, Soledad said.
I'm glad Chiren could be helpful. She's quite the intellect, Vector said, with the stiff formality of a superior praising hired help he more often had to reprimand.
Looking after my paladins is an enormous responsibility, one that has forced her to narrow her focus. If there were more hours in the day and more days in the week, I'm sure she would already have developed this chip herself. As it is, I'm sure Dyson Ido used a great deal of her work. So really, what I'm asking you to do is to retrieve property that is rightfully Chiden's.
Why did I just tell her that? Vector thought as Soledad nodded.
I'm sure, given world enough and time, Dr. Chiren could master any skill, even breaking and entering, Soledad said, although I doubt she'd want to.
And why did she just say that to me? Vector wondered.
Pushing the thought away, he said,
You have the latest reports on Ido's daily movements?
Soledad tapped her phone. The gentleman is a creature of routine, but I have contingency plans in the event he takes a walk on the wild side. Breaks his pattern, she added in response to Vector's slightly perplexed expression.
Very good, he said. And you're sure you won't have a drink with me before you go?
Another time, thank you. Soledad stood up, and Vector immediately followed suit. She was several inches shorter than he was, but sometimes she seemed taller.
Then don't let me keep you, my dear, Vector said, dismissing her before she could leave the room without his permission.
Oh, I wasn't, Soledad told him. I stopped by in case you needed to say anything else to me. I'll call you when the job's done.
Don't bother, he said, as she started to turn towards the door. Just bring me the chip.
She nodded. As you wish.
Vector stared after her as she strode out of his office. He wasn't used to feeling relieved when a beautiful woman left his office, and he didn't like it.
The open-air taqueria across the street from the clinic was getting busy, Ido saw as he locked up. For a moment, he stood and listened to the sound of cheerful voices calling to each other over the sound of the highlights of the latest motorball game, whenever that was. One of the waitresses hollered something to the bartender, and he hollered back. Ido couldn't make out what either of them had said over the noise, but it made everyone sitting nearby laugh uproariously. Ido smiled. People were people were people. No matter where they were or what was going on, they'd find some way to have a good time, at least for a little while. The idea made him feel hopeful. Maybe when he was done picking through Zalim's refuse, he'd have a couple of tacos before going out to his second job. So that was Chiren's ex-husband, Soledad thought, staring after him as he headed for the scrapyard. It was the first time she'd seen him in person. Unless she was mistaken, he almost had a spring in his step. Maybe something almost good had happened to him today. That would be a nice change. Tormented soul seemed to be his default setting. Either way, he'd be gone for at least an hour. She could have hired a lookout to text her when Ido headed for home, but that meant involving someone else in the job, even if she didn't give them any details. The fewer people who were connected to you by way of a job, the less likely it was to come back and bite you on the ass. You never knew who might add two and two and get you. No one had seen Soledad leave the taqueria. Since departing from Vector's office, she had shifted her cyborg bone structure so that her eyes turned down at the outer corners, as did her mouth, which now had pronounced marionette lines and incipient jowls to go with her double chin. It was the face of any older woman who had spent most of her life trying to be useful, knowing she would be singled out only for admonition, never for applause. This face was a composite of many different women, familiar enough to pass unquestioned, unfamiliar enough to be ignored. Even after so many years,
Soledad was still amazed at how easy it was to be invisible. Sometimes she stood right in front of someone without being noticed. As for her clothing, everything she wore was reversible. Turning her clothes inside out was effective, simple, and far less uncomfortable than shifting the bones in her face. Ito lived above his clinic, so there were two separate entrances. Soledad decided the entrance to his home would be safer. There would be less chance of bumping into a patient looking for out-of-hours treatment. Traffic was heavy in this part of town. There seemed to be virtually no time when the streets were completely clear. Very useful. No one paid any attention to her on Ito's porch. Ito used a standard lock and key setup, which Soledad thought matched his image as charmingly retro and eccentric. He was too smart to use an electronic lock, which could easily be disabled just by cutting the power. In her extreme youth, Soledad had learned to pick just about any kind of mechanical lock with patient manipulation. Having a superior set of lock-picking equipment was a definite advantage, especially when there was a clock on the job. And when it came to burglary, there usually was. Once inside, Soledad stood in the dark for a few moments, listening to the way things sounded in the house, the muffled traffic noise, her breathing, the air contained in the place, the lonely darkness. She committed all of it to memory, then put on her night vision goggles. To her left was the living room, to her right the kitchen, and beyond that, the clinic. She went soundlessly through the kitchen to a hallway and was surprised by a spiral staircase. Chidin hadn't mentioned it was a spiral staircase. Soledad leaned on it slightly. There was no movement or rattling. Pretty solid for such an old house. The place looked like it could be pre-war. There were a surprising number of pre-war buildings in Iron City. Vector claimed parts of the factory predated the war, but Soledad took everything he said with a grain of salt. She memorized the layout of the clinic, at first seeing it all at once, as a whole, and then in smaller sections, until the room was as much in her as she was in it. Not a very large room at all, crowded and, though not tidy, not disorganized. As she moved into the space, she passed a tray table on wheels with an arrangement of surgical instruments laid out on it, still in their sterile wrap. Ito liked the convenience of having anything he was actively working on within easy reach when he returned to it, like those two arms on the table. They were definitely for two different people. One of them was a strange creation she'd never seen before, with a forearm that divided in two at the elbow, opening like alligator jaws. The double forearm connected to an even weirder extended double hand, both sections with five finger-like appendages. She couldn't imagine what it was for. Some kind of special sex aid, maybe? Ito wasn't known for that kind of thing, but maybe with his wife gone, he was branching out. Soledad bent over the table and set her vision for extreme close-up. She found a chip right in the spot Chidan had said was the controller position, but it was plain old tech, not the super chip Chidan had described. No super chip in the other arm either, which was a standard laborer's device with attachments for tools. "If it's not in the clinic, try the cellar safe. It's set into the floor," Chidan had said, giving her the combination. Ito might have changed it, but she didn't think so. He hadn't. The safe was full of drugs, in bags, in bottles, in bundles of flat patches, in pre-measured ampules. Everything the average motorball washout needed to keep the party going. Soledad was afraid she was going to have to remove at least half of it to find what she was looking for. Then she spotted what looked like a small paper envelope stuck to one side of the safe. There it was, and so thin she was afraid she'd snap it in two by accident. But it was oddly strong, like a small steel plate. She saw lines on both sides, but they were indecipherable to her eye. God, how the hell did something like this work? Soledad put it in the small plastic container Chiden had given her, started to put it in one of her pockets, then tucked it into her bra next to her right breast. If anyone reached for that, they'd come away shy one hand, regular or cyborg. She made her way